opened the Senate Revenue Committee. Today we were hearing first Senate Bill 362, and then we will follow with Senate Bill 778. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 362. Lizbeth.
Chair Deckert and committee members, for the record, I'm Lizbeth Martin-Mahar with the Legislative Revenue Office. So with Senate Bill 362, this is providing an income tax exemption for 7 years for senior executive managers of a venture capitalist firm that invests at least $2 million in Oregon businesses in the previous 12 months. The venture capital firm also has to have a $75 million in available capital to invest. It allows also an income tax exemption for 7 years for university senior research faculty who conduct new lines of research in Oregon, which have stable funding and commercial applications in the research areas of biosciences, computer software, technology, and commercial applications, communications equipment, and other innovative technology. It is also requiring the qualified manager of the income tax exemption to have the authority to make fundamental business decisions for the venture capital firm. It requires that the qualified university faculty to make fundamental decisions about the direction of the research conducted by the university. It outlines the initial and annual application processes by which the taxpayer will apply to the Economic Community Development Department for certification for the income tax exemption. It also places different qualification requirements on taxpayers for continuing the income tax exemption versus initial qualification for the tax exemption. It specifies that the income tax exemption consists of wages, salaries, guaranteed payments, bonuses, commissions, transfers of stocks and gains from the sale of stock or other ownership interest in the firm without regard to whether or not the taxpayer acquired the stock or ownership in the interest from the firm or elsewhere. It compels the Economic Community Development Department to prepare reports detailing the effectiveness of the income tax exemption for the 2005 and 7 legislatures. And the income tax exemption applies to initial or annual certifications filed with Community and Economic Development Department beginning on or after January 1st, 2003, and it takes effect 21 days or 91 days after the end of the legislative session. So you have the -1 amendment that basically is dealing with the qualifications for a university faculty member and having being a senior researcher, having a PhD, and experience in commercializing research. And as far as the revenue impact, I haven't done a formal one yet, but I just gave you there a list of basically some of the issues which are adding to the uncertainty to the revenue impact for this bill. And to begin with, on the venture capitalist income tax exemption, first of all, it's unclear how many managers per venture capitalist firm could claim the income tax exemption for the $2 million of investment. Again, the venture capitalist firm has to invest $2 million into several businesses or one business in the state of Oregon, and then you get an income tax exemption for 7 years. So there's not a limit on the number of venture capitalists who can claim this, who consider themselves to be executive managers of the firm. There could be great variability in the income of the manager of the venture capitalist firm. That is also indicative of the way in which this income definition in the bill is very broadly written to capture all the different stock options and interests that there may be in the firm. So there is a great deal of variability there, as well as just getting salaries on venture capitalists. Also, there is no cap on the total certification that OECD can certify each year. Also, the definition of business operations is very broadly defined. It's not clear whether or not a firm or venture capitalist firm could, what exactly they would have to do in order to, quote-unquote, establish business in Oregon, if it would just be, you know, a particular office, or what exactly would have to transpire with that. And on the research faculty side, it lacks a definition for what constitutes a new line of research. Is that just, you know, publications, which then, you know, lead to some sort of agreement with companies with commercialization of that research? It's not. I think most assistant professors and, you know, would argue that, you know, most people don't continue to stay in a university setting unless they have new lines of research. So how that is really restricting certain faculty members seems to all be revolving around whether or not they have commercialized and brought their research to the business community. It's unclear what actually constitutes stable and ongoing funding. This again becomes one of the criterias for first establishing it, but then even in the future years, the annual application for the faculty members from the Economic Community Development Department, it's not clear if you had stable funding for 2 years, if you would then, be able to get the income tax exemption for 7 years, or exactly what is the time period then that you're establishing stable funding to then justify your 7 years of a future income tax exemption. Obviously, one of the criteria for continuing your exemption is still being a faculty member at the university. But again, one other criteria that's not real clear is it allows faculty to be employed by any university, not just Oregon universities. Now, obviously, in order to have income taxes here in Oregon, you have to establish some linkage to wages here in Oregon. And so that obviously lends itself to Oregon universities. But it could be such that you were a faculty member at Washington State University and Vancouver office, and, you did some research, you did your capitalization and commercialization of your research here in Oregon, then it's not clear if they would qualify or not. But the point is you don't need an Oregon residency in order to be that's not a requirement for the personal income tax exemption in either case.
Mr. Alley. And Mr. Gibson and Mr. Barnes, you have a friendly audience. Afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo. My name is Alan Alley. I'm the CEO, chairman, and president of a company called Pixelworks here in Tualatin, Oregon. I'm also the chairman of the Oregon Council for Knowledge and Economic Development, also known as OCED. And this bill was spawned out of some work that we did in OCED, and I wanted to speak on behalf of this bill and support of it. In my past, I was also a venture capitalist, and I actually have direct experience in terms of states providing incentives to relocate a venture partner, in this case it was me, from Boston, Massachusetts to Ann Arbor, Michigan, and the state was the state of Michigan. These types of incentives do work. I moved from Boston to Ann Arbor. I set up an office in Ann Arbor. Battery Ventures my venture firm turned out to be one of the largest venture firms in the country. I probably saw several hundred deals during the time that I was in Ann Arbor. I think the most important thing was I actually started a seed fund that, even though I moved to Oregon to join InFocus Systems, that seed fund is still in Michigan, has funded probably 50 companies in Michigan, is on their third fund that they've raised. They've probably raised $200 million in that time period. So I'm here to testify that these incentives absolutely do work. I think we have a unique situation here in Oregon where the state just to our north has these sorts of incentives built into its tax structure currently. And venture capitalists that are concentrated in the Bay Area and California, if they have an alternative of setting up a residence or moving to an environment that's probably a little more pleasant than the environment that they're living in California, they have an alternative in Washington to move to Washington. And we're at a severe handicap here in Oregon to not be able to offer the same types of environmental of tax incentives for somebody to move here. So I'm speaking from experience. They work. I was a person that did it. The benefits of it are clearly defined in my role in Michigan and what has been left behind in my wake. And I think we absolutely need to do something like this just to put us on parity with our friends to the north in Washington.
My name is Scott Gibson, also on the OCED committee and running the capital formation committee of OCED. So my committee put together this bill. I've worked around venture capital for 30 years. I might add, by the way, no one of the four of us who are testifying will have any personal benefit from this. None of us are venture capitalists. None of us would qualify. In fact, we set the bar on this bill in terms of criteria so high just so that virtually no one within the state would qualify, and it would serve to just attract people to move their primary residence to Oregon and bring capital to Oregon. But I can tell you firsthand, I'm watching a whole generation of companies either not get started or choke to death because of the lack of syndication of venture capital. In other words, we have with Smart Forest and OVP some venture capital that gets companies started, but then we quickly are having trouble attracting California or Washington or other venture capitalists. And no one is going into a deal alone anymore because of the torturous environment financially that we've been through. And so without a syndicate, deals are not getting done, companies are dying, and I'm watching this happen on a real-time basis. And it could be a 10-year sort of scar on the lack of initial public offerings and successful companies like Allen's, Pixelworks, or my ex-company Sequent from the 80s. So there is an acute shortage of venture capital. New funds are not going to be formed right now. I can assure you that anyone trying to raise a brand new fund who doesn't have a 10 or 20 year track record of previous funds will have no chance for success in raising a new fund. So as we studied this issue, how do we solve that problem? The only way we could see to solve the problem was bring California, Washington, and other states' venture capitalist partners to Oregon. Move the partner. Don't try and move the money, and move access to that money. Now, in drafting this bill, and if we've drafted it improperly, we'll more than happy to make an amendment and fix this. People have to invest $2 million each year to qualify for the tax exemption each year. So they don't get a seven-year tax exemption by qualifying once. So let me be clear on that. So unless someone has consistently access to a lot of capital, $75 million, they invest two of it in Oregon every single year, they don't qualify for the tax exemption. We set that bar so high in terms of access to new capital to, again, make sure we were going after the really big fish here, the really top venture capitalists with very large funds. We're only targeting 5 to 10 people over the next 2 to 3 years, 5 to 10 people that would move their primary residence from California or Washington to Oregon. And if you use the numbers and even use the minimum numbers, that's 5 to 10 people with access to $75 million each moving to Oregon and investing $10 million of that per year. My company, Sequent, had its initial venture investment was $5 million, and within 5 years, we employed 2,200 people. So this isn't a pipe dream that it can't create a lot of jobs. It can't create them in a month, but it certainly can get us ready for the next upturn and the next downturn, which is something we have to be mindful to. On the signature research part, we've got Jim Johnson to testify on that, so I won't discuss that particular piece. There are two people, to my knowledge, in venture capital in Oregon who would qualify. That's Dave Chen and Jerry Langler of OVP. Both have told me that they will either create a document that says they won't be applying for this, or we can ask them to sign something. What the reason they wanted to do that was in support of this bill to say that we can truly say it is revenue neutral, because the two people in our state who would qualify won't be seeking OECD certification. So if that doesn't speak volumes about their support in terms of what they think this can do to bring capital, I think it really is. And then this bill, in conjunction with what we're doing with foundations, to try and coordinate foundations who already invest in venture capital to invest in the same Northern California and Seattle venture capitalists, encouraging them to put partners here. The state has already successfully done that with OVP, and OHSU Foundation has already taken this step with Alloy Ventures of San Francisco and OVP. And now OVP has half of their partners in Oregon as a result of that state investment. And yet the state is enjoying top-tier returns. OVP has an outstanding record, as does Alloy Ventures. So we'll continue that with Murdoch, Meyer, Jelwyn, all the different foundations to try and coordinate their investment in venture capitalists who will be interested in putting a partner in Oregon and bringing that capital to Oregon. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Keith Barnes. I was the chairman and chief executive officer of Oregon's 40th largest public company, IMS, Integrated Measurement Systems, which I retired from in January of this year, and am kind of ducking below the radar with respect to this lousy economy that's going on. But I've been involved with venture capital for quite a few years. My company was a venture capital startup company. A lot of the companies in the Oregon area that were successful in the last several years were venture capital companies. And in 1994, when I was chairing the American Electronics Association, we did a study on venture capital in the state of Oregon. And some of the information that came from that was pretty interesting. This was a report that was commissioned and done pro bono by Price Waterhouse, Arthur Andersen, and Pete Marwick, the three top accounting firms. So in the period, I'll try to get the numbers exactly right, but in the period from 1983 through 1988, there was a little over $500 million invested in the state of Oregon in venture capital. And a lot of the companies that came from that were companies like my own, Scott's company, Sequent Computer, and a whole series of other companies that you know, like Mentor Graphics and so forth, who have employed thousands of people in the state of Oregon and who have generated or helped to generate payroll taxes and corporate taxes, which in good times can really make a big difference. Venture capital is one of those things that unfortunately has peaked and dropped pretty precipitously in Oregon. In that next five-year period from 88 through 93, it dropped to under $100 million. So from $500 million or greater than $500 down to below $100 million. Then in the next five-year period, it went up a little bit to about $150 to $200 million, and now it's dropping off pretty dramatically. One of the reasons why it works when it works is because there is money which primes the pump. In other words, there are some local venture people who leverage people out of state and other limited partners. And that isn't occurring now. We're not getting that out-of-state leveraging, and this is one of the programs that I think is pretty creative with respect to drawing those kinds of people in. To give you an idea of that leveraging effect, if you were to put a couple million dollars into a venture capital firm here as a limited partner, it's likely that you would end up getting about a 10-to-1 leverage of other limited partners in that program, and then they would also go outside the state to pull people in from Washington or from California and get about another, you know, 10-to-15-time leverage, plus any small business SBA monies that they could do in a 2-to-1 match. So you get this huge leveraging effect with a fairly small amount of money priming the pump. I think that this program that we're sponsoring is similar in that if it's crafted correctly with the appropriate incentives, it brings those people from out of state that we otherwise might not see if there aren't incentives for them. I think it's very good for Oregon. There's a lot of companies that have been started through this mechanism. Right now is a very difficult time in terms of job growth and getting reasonable wages in the state. And it's been proved through a lot of different studies that the highest number of new jobs are created from small companies. So, you know, to the extent that we can put a small amount of incentive to draw capital from outside the state to invest in our companies in Oregon and get the kind of results that we've gotten in the past, I think it's a very good use of the legislative process. So thank you.
Thank you.
Do you want to hear from Jim Johnson before questions, or what would you like to
Maybe we'll hold the panel for just one moment on this. Questions or comments? Senator Ringo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for testifying this afternoon. I met with most of you earlier today, and I expressed my support for the bill. And I am reluctant to sign on to tax credits, given our current situation where we've given so many away that are really causing problems from a macro sense. But I wondered if you could respond, or even, Mr. Chair, if you might, to our committee staff's comments about certain portions of the bill that seem, I don't know if ambiguous is the right word, but whether it's tight enough. And I just would appreciate some comments on that.
I think, Scott, what I'd like to do is maybe have you and Lizbeth after, we won't move the bill this afternoon, just to make sure that we've tightened up everything.
Happy to do that.
The idea also. And the kernel, I think, has gotten just about universal support from what I found. And so if you might be willing to sit down with Lizbeth after we get done with the hearing, and we can get any amendments that need to be drafted done in a couple of days and bring them back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But I guess I would ask, I mean, Scott in particular, I think during some of those comments was making some facial.
Yep.
But what do you, what's your 30-second response to some of those? Are you able to?
It really truly was written in an attempt, and maybe we haven't written it properly, that someone had to reapply every year and had to meet the criteria every year to get the tax incentive, that they had to relocate their primary residence to Oregon. And on the signature research side, it sounds like that one we didn't word as tightly as we should. Now, at the time, we didn't know what the signature research focus area was going to be. And so I can see now that we do, we can tighten that piece up to say it only applies to researchers in the multi-scale device and nanotechnology area, period. That's the only area of research that a signature researcher could apply for. So one way or the other, we'll tighten these up.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, just to follow up. So,
and
with respect to where the investor must live, I mean, there was some comment, perhaps it could live on the other side of the river, but you want to make... It should be nailed down. They're going to be
still have their primary residence in Oregon. Yes.
Okay.
And register with the state.
OECDD has to certify all this. That they were the mechanism. In fact, there was a fee that had to be put up so it could be, again, self-funded. I think it was $2,000 every year. Mm-hmm. And so that person, they'd have to have certified they are a principal, a partner in a qualified venture capital, so they have access to this at least $75 million. They've made $2 million investments in that calendar year, and their primary residence is in Oregon. If any of those criteria weren't met, they could not achieve the tax credit that year.
Thank you very much.
We really want this to be tight.
And on the committee, we were pretty clear what we were after. And so if we need to just really hone in on that, I think there was... I don't feel a lot of questions about what we were trying to incent.
In fact, we were trying to make the criteria even tougher and got talked in a, you know, it's still very, very tough that, as I say, only two people in Oregon in the VC community would even technically qualify.
Mr. Johnson.
Before I talk about the signature research, I just want to take a step back and put this all into context. Oregon is one of few states in which the high-tech industry has become its predominant economic engine. And the economic laws of the high-tech world are different than more traditional, especially resource extraction industries. In our industry, every 18 months, you turn your entire product line over. A company as large as Intel will generate much more than 50% of their revenue from products that didn't exist 18 months ago. So this whole notion about constantly reinventing yourself is very important. And so in the high-tech world, during a downturn, we have three laws. The recession will end, which right now it's really hard to believe, but the recession will end. During a recession, you cut your expenses because you have to live within your means, but you also invest in your future. And that's for the third law that says market share shifts occur on the upswing. So if we're especially in this very long recession, there may be companies that are going to have to make two rounds of technology investments to get that payoff that when the recovery occurs, they're there. Because their competitors that don't do that, they'll never recover. Because when it happens, the customer wants it now, you deliver now, they can't say wait. So this notion of investing in the future is ingrained in this new information age. And so as Oregon begins to look at its economic roadmap and its future, historically, it could cut when bad times hit, and when the good times came, it would rise because as the economy rose, it would just go with it because of a natural resource base. But in the high-tech world, that's not, you cannot guarantee that. You can be a cyber leader this period, go through a recession, and not emerge as a cyber leader. And so what Signature Research is all about is transitioning Oregon's high-tech economy from one in which we received it all. I mean, except for just a few entrepreneurs in this room, which there might be all of them right here. You know, most of Oregon's high-tech income comes from companies that were founded someplace else, grew someplace else, outgrew that spot instead of being wanting to move to Oregon, and then have grown it here. So the more you can grow it here and have the headquarters here, the more you're in control. And so what Oregon has to be looking at is creating new companies, creating the next Intel here in Oregon, right? We have candidates right here, but they'll actually all three have gone through mergers, right? And so where that's going to happen, who knows? So you can't just do one and say you're done. You got to do lots and create it. So what the Signature Research is about is creating a critical mass of knowledge in this state that is world class. That when you say multi-scale materials and devices, anywhere in the world, people will say, I need to go to Oregon to get that because that's the best in the world. You said, go ahead.
Senator Farrelly, just wanted to jump in.
Just, Mr. Chairman, I find these arguments so persuasive, perhaps we shouldn't let them leave the building.
Ever?
You got my drift.
Place.
Okay, I guess I should be a good salesman and move on. Sounds like I have the order. So the whole concept around the Signature Research is get that world-class research done here. One of the big challenges we have is we do need to have incentives. The reality is that Oregon isn't a place that people are naturally going to come here because of those economic incentives. If you can move, if you're a venture capitalist and you can move on the other side of the river and not pay taxes, you're going to move to the other side of the river because whether you fly out of Portland and you live in Vancouver, you fly out of Portland, live in Portland, or someplace else in Oregon, it makes a little difference to them, right? So we need to be competitive. And the same thing on these signature researchers. You know, I'm sure in other committees they're looking at the Oregon University System pay scale. And of our peers, we are the bottom. So here we are trying to be world-class, attracting the best researchers, and we're going to ask them to come to a place where they'll get the worst pay they could get any place in. So we have to complement that in any way we can, in whatever creative way we can. So if we can find that intersection of where a researcher will help bring world-class capabilities to this state, if we can supplement their income by, again, with the right criteria around it and filters and make it appropriate and tight. We're not trying to make this for everybody, but for those key people that can really help turn Oregon's future economy around, I believe this is an absolute creative solution to that problem and at minimal cost to the state.
Senator Farrelly?
No, I think we're going to have Scott after we're done work with Lisbeth just to make sure that we tighten the bill appropriately. And maybe that leads to actually a good question. When we discussed this, we were talking just a number of individuals, and that really gets to the whole revenue. For me, this has been somewhat of a revenue positive because you require the $2 million annual investment, but I think that in no way does that preclude, and I think if you look at investment patterns of funds that do put the residency here, they tend to be well beyond that $2 million in terms of investment, and I think that's been missing from this discussion.
And we did quantify. I didn't cover it. I should have. If you assumed that every $5 million invested was created a Sequent or a Pixelworks, you really do get to about 50,000 jobs at the 10-year mark. And then doing, I did accrued income tax and corporate tax and came up with about $375 million of new state revenues at the 10-year mark. And maybe half of that at the five-year mark. Well, that's not insignificant. So it doesn't cost us because these people are all moving here, and yet it creates something that gives us revenue. It's exactly what our companies have done by creating something out of nothing.
The other thing that's nice about this is there's very little downside costs. If you do it and they don't come, it hasn't cost you anything. So we're not saying, please give us $10 million for a recruitment campaign, and we'll spend the $10 million and maybe they'll come, right? So again, it's, I think, very well thought out. It's got very little downside risk, and it has a huge amount of upside potential.
In fact, the marketing campaign for this is phone calls and emails that we'll all do on a personal basis, just because we know these folks. We know where they live. We know their emails. We work with them all the time. We know where we want them to live.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Opened by saying this wouldn't benefit you personally, but I think, and I'm biased, this will benefit the state of Oregon in terms of job creation and ending a recession. So
absolutely.
Our thanks are to you. Thanks.
Thank you.
Mr. Slater.
All right, Chairman Decker and members of the committee, my name is Michael Slater, and I'm the political director for SEIU Local 503, Oregon Public Employees Union, and a member of the Revenue Coalition. And I'm one of the almost in the almost universal support because I'm here to testify briefly in opposition to this bill. Let me say at the outset of my testimony that Local 503 shares the committee's goal of increasing economic investment that leads to high-quality jobs for Oregonians. We also recognize this bill has a number of features of a good tax expenditure. It's narrowly drawn, it aims to create quality jobs, one of the criteria of the Revenue Coalition, and it establishes reporting requirements. However, SB 362 has several problems that lead us to oppose its passage. The first and most compelling drawback is that it creates a new tax expenditure but fails to identify any existing expenditures that can be reduced or repealed as an offset. And as a matter of fact, it sounded as if we're unsure how many people would qualify for this and what the overall cost would be in the long run. One of the most important criteria of the Revenue Coalition is that no new tax expenditures be adopted without removing an existing tax break of equal cost but of lesser policy value. At a time when we're expecting a $2 billion budget shortfall, we simply cannot afford to continue to collect only 42 cents on the dollar. Secondly, we're uncomfortable with any tax expenditure that makes up in taxes on workers what it foregoes in taxes from owners and investors. SB 362 is based on the premise that taxes on the income of jobs created by this bill will more than compensate for the loss of income tax on the investors and owners. This is akin to a pyramid scheme where lower-wage workers foot the bill for their better-paid employers and investors. In other words, labor pays, but capital gets a free ride, and we're uncomfortable with that notion. Finally, I think this bill sends the wrong message to the Oregon public. It sends a message that school children and seniors need to tighten their belts and state workers need to share in the pain, but wealthy investors are exempt from sacrifice. This is the wrong message. At a time of war and economic downturn, we need to protect the poor and most vulnerable in our community. This means reducing the overall cost of tax expenditure and raising new revenue. On a larger perspective, I want to rebut just a couple notions. One is that, you know, what attracts quality jobs and what attracts quality investment to a state? I think quality public services, a good health care system, access to markets, high quality and skilled workforce is what attracts investments, not individual incentives to investors. And I think that we need to promote a strategy about improving the quality of public services and restoring the cuts to K-12 education, and that's going to contribute to the long-term economic health, not creating incentives for a small group of investors.
Okay. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Patrick Green, and I'm also a member of the Revenue Coalition. I just wanted to add a couple things. One, and maybe these are sort of in the works, one is just to, I think that before we move forward on this bill, we need to see an OTIM analysis of how many jobs will be created, how much, we do that for, we have some studies that were cited, or a particular study that was cited by the panel, and I think that we need to see, is that true, and to what extent there are jobs created. Also, in terms of leveraging dollars, we could leverage dollars in the up and down world of high tech, or we could decide to leverage dollars in the world of healthcare, as an example. I mean, there's lots of ways that you can leverage dollars. We could, through the Ways and Means process, do, you know, 70-30 with federal Medicare and Medicaid money. That and as Paul Warner and in revenue demonstrated at the very beginning of this session, that's the one sector that keeps going up, right? It's healthcare. So let's get on, you know, let's get on the train and keep pushing. I mean, there's lots of different ways that we could approach this. The other question I think is that you know, one of the questions this bill brings to mind is, what about the companies already in Oregon, and not just in high tech, but, you know, all the folks in who've been laid off in the aluminum industry because of the rising energy costs. I mean, those are good living wage jobs here too, and we already have workers who can work in them, you know, we should sort of balance. I know that it's a balancing act, and you're trying to sort of work your way through this. But you know, figuring out a way for some of these blue collar jobs that provide living wage jobs in communities across the state in both metals and timber is something worth looking at as well, if we're talking about an overall development strategy. So thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I've got a couple questions. Just if it's prospective. Well, maybe the first question, I know this dates your arrival in Oregon, but you might agree that technology in general in the 90s was one of the major areas of job growth in terms of providing more revenue to fund schools and healthcare. Is that a fair?
I would agree with that, Mr. Chair.
So I guess the question I have, if this is prospective, to leverage a new investment, at least $2 million annually, how could this have a negative, and maybe it's quite possible that I'm just not seeing it clear, how could this possibly have a net negative revenue impact if it's leveraging new dollars to the state, which are then going to be translated up into $2 million investment in startup companies, which have to be jobs, which would also pay income property tax?
Mr. Chair, again, Patrick Green, maybe it's an oversight on my part in reading the bill, but in terms of, you know, where the job guarantees are. I mean, you can invest $2 million, but how many jobs is that? I mean, there's lots of setup costs and lots of, I mean, that's $2 million and, you know, how many workers is that and how much are they making? And that, I mean, that's would be the question I would have in response to that. I mean, maybe you do get them, but.
But wouldn't even want, I mean, I guess, just in this somewhat philosophical, but wouldn't even, although I would argue, I think you could, if you look at past history, it would demonstrate whether Sequent, which is a good example, but many others, that you could have exponential growth. But even it's 10, wouldn't that be preferable to zero if it's new jobs in the state and new revenue and a new investor to make those investments?
Mr. Chair, I mean, in a vacuum, I would say, yeah, I mean, 10 new jobs, bring it on. I mean, and we need them, right? And we have the highest unemployment rate. A lot of our members are unemployed. In the building trades, you know, we've got 30 to 40 to 50% unemployment in some of our building trades locals. I mean, we've got folks who are really hurting. So I'm not going to argue against 10 new jobs, bring it on. The question is, you know, sort of in the, and again, this is something that I know that all of you are weighing in terms of building the budget, and we're, you know, sort of, you know, I know that you guys are sort of considering the long-term investment and being pulled by very compelling case that one of the major industries in the state is making. And on the other hand, I think like Michael Slater said, you know, there's the whole services and the K-12 and some of the other industries that are already here that are hurting. And so I don't pretend to have the magic answer. So.
Senator Farrelly.
No, Mr. Chairman, I think the questions that you're asking are important to be discussed. In an industrial setting, in a much more traditionally based manufacturing setting, the minimum multiplier would be 15,000 per job created. Mm-hmm. And we are smarting from a series of audits that were performed by the Secretary of State relative to Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. For lack of accountability, we've been through a brutal 2 years over the issue of accountability in direct lending, and this is a tax credit discussion. It may be a slightly different cast to the discussion, but I think the chairman's right to at least to surface the discussion for the record. What can we expect? What should we expect? And maybe the the issue of surfacing that discussion about expectations is the best that we can do to try to tie these kinds of investments, and every tax credit is an investment, to something specific means that we're trying accountability, trying to go toward accountability. And I'm certain you've been watching the Oregonian in the last several days about accountability and legislators. The very important meetings that happen to be held in Maui, and even the chair that I happen to be sitting in, $700 example of accountability, perhaps had gone wrong. But nonetheless, I think the chairman's exactly right. We're going to be expected to be weighing all these incentives that we're offering against the benefit, and all unfortunately cast in the in combination with issues like health services and the senior services. I do absolutely believe that priming the pump in the high-tech sector will pay huge dividends. And I can make that argument to anybody that asks me, but as a public policy, I think that the chairman's right to surface the question and ask for some sort of accountability measure.
Thank you. Senator Ringo.
Thank you. Thanks for your testimony. I am very reluctant to look at new tax credits, and I really appreciate what the research, what the Revenue Coalition is doing in terms of trying to clamp down on some of the tax credits. For me, it comes down to will this tax credit apply to anybody that's currently in Oregon, or can it only apply to somebody that's going to come to Oregon bringing their money with them? And I'm persuaded that the latter is true. I mean, it requires $75 million of unobligated funds. And, you know, I think you're looking at it, just not that many people around the country have that much money. Maybe a couple people in Oregon, and they're not going to take advantage of it. So from my perspective, we're not giving a tax credit that is going to take money away. It's going to take money away from the general fund. I just don't see that happening. And unless you can persuade me that that is what would happen, then I intend to support the bill. Because I really am persuaded we're focused on people that will come here.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, I mean, once we see the... I wouldn't want to comment on sort of the first part of, you know, whether or not, you know, they would come here and that sort of thing until we see the bill. I mean, one of the things that I guess that in terms of the, you know, the jobs, it's sort of like it's a very seductive idea. I mean, the more I thought about before coming up here, the more, you know, and the compelling case laid out by the proponents. But, you know, on the other hand, there's also other incentives that we could be looking at more along the lines of some of the, you know, with job guarantees, with job, you know, sort of through the strategic investment program and that sort of thing. I mean, it's just like, I don't know if it'll have an impact on the general fund, and until we see the analysis from legislative revenue. I mean, that's why I didn't come up and, you know, sort of trot out the $1 million list, because I don't know if we don't know yet. But I understand. I know that you've been listening to the work of the Revenue Coalition. We appreciate that. So.
And I will continue to do so.
Great.
Senator Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill and actually the series of OCED bills are clearly about growing Oregon's economic pie, not reallocating the existing pie. This is about adding value and without a vision like we have in these series of bills, the programs that your constituents help to run as state employees are going to continue to shrink and diminish because the dollars that are coming into the state won't be there. I'm really excited about this proposal because, again, it grows Oregon. It grows our economy. It grows that economic value, and it's additive, not subtractive. It's the right thing to do. You mentioned the strategic reserve. If we take money and put it in the strategic reserve, you're taking it from somewhere else. That's reallocation of existing resource. This is about growing the pie. This is about bringing outside dollars into the state. This is exciting. Mr. Chair, I can't be more supportive of the kind of vision that I see in black and white before me today.
appreciate it. I tend to agree. I mean, the only point I guess I would offer up, and I appreciate the time you've given to us, is that without making investments in innovation, and if the state doesn't, and this was a pretty tireless process of finding four or five ideas that actually might attract new capital, new investment to the state, and I guess that's the only question that might be on the table for us, is without finding investment opportunities, my fear is that we would be here in 5 years and 6 years debating a shrinking pie and allocating that shrinking pie. And so at least that's the intent behind this, and we may have to agree to disagree, but I know that the intent from the panel that presented this and the group OCAD was really how do you provide for economic growth and what incentives is it going to take to really spur the kind of growth that we saw in the mid-90s.
Chairman Deckard and members of the committee, I tried to be careful when I came in to recognize the fact that I think we do have a shared goal of growing the economic pie. And I don't think that our testimony here is to critique or criticize venture capital or investors, because that is an important part of what makes economies grow. I think there is a philosophical difference that we're having in this, more than a technical difference, and that is the value of creating incentives for individual investors on their personal income tax versus other forms of incentive. And again, I go back to our belief that the incentive for people to locate and do business in a state is about the quality of public services and the quality of the workforce and education, rather than tax incentives for individual investors. In 1999, Ernst & Young did a survey of what makes businesses relocate. Number 10 on the list was the tax structure. You know, 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 were all about education, workforce development, and infrastructure. So if you're asking where we ought to put our time and attention, you know, I've already leaned in that direction. So I think we are at a philosophical difference, but we did want to come and make our point today.
Thanks for your time.
Thanks.
Anyone else on Senate Bill 362? Close the public hearing. My intention was, committee, to move the bill, but Scott, if you would just be willing to just get together with Elizabeth and maybe if Dexter is available, who drafted the bill, and if you have 10 to 15 minutes, just make sure that we're right where we want to be with this.
Senator Stark, directly to the floor. It doesn't have to go to Ways and Means or anywhere. It's
no.
Here to the floor.
Here to the floor.
Excellent.
Appreciate it. Thanks.
Thank you. Yeah, I think I got a good idea.
Do you want to introduce this bill?
Sure.
Appreciate your comments. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 778. Senator Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a bill that I introduced relating to the redevelopment, really, and rehabilitation of historic property. The bill is a tax credit bill, which means, obviously, it faces a little bit of tough sledding in our tight economic times. But the bill, as it's drafted, has a good relating clause, quite frankly, Mr. Chair and Senator Ferrioli. And we've got a couple of folks that have signed up to testify on the bill. Both actually signed up in opposition or against the bill. My sense is that it's more technically the bill as opposed to and how the bill is drafted, as opposed to the overall idea about using historic preservation as a redevelopment tool. My goal would be, Mr. Chair, is to put together kind of a work group that would look at this issue in the long run and recommend to the next legislature some opportunities we may have in this area, really, to look at historic preservation as an economic development tool, and use it as and recommend to us some strategies that the legislature could perhaps put in statute to incent developers who've got a historic piece of property that want to put a deal together I think we've got experts really in the private sector all over the state that can help us accomplish that. And so that would be my ultimate goal. And I'd welcome to hear the opinions of the two folks that have signed up to testify today.
Yeah, my interest in discussing this bill with the sponsor was just that, is that I think there could be a good vehicle here to achieve that, of how you leverage, use something in this arena, and whether it's properly placed in the right department now or if that's bears more exploration. I think that's an important question, too. But how you might use this as a leverage in terms of housing decisions and other deals that might be brought together. Mr. Hamrick. Afternoon.
Afternoon, Mr. Chairman. Senator Starr, Senator Ferrielli, James Hamrick. I'm the Assistant Director for Heritage Conservation at Parks and Recreation Department, and it would be our department that would be administering this bill if it was passed. And I do appreciate Senator Starr's when I first saw this bill emerge. We've been trying to get this concept on the docket for, this is the third legislative session, and this type of incentive is the most frequently used incentive for historic preservation in the United States, and there are about half the states in the country now have these tax credits. It's odd for me to sit in front of you and say, well, I'm not in favor of this, because I have, in fact, been rather bullishly trying to get this done for many years. So when I saw the legislation, I actually felt like I had run into or discovered a long-lost friend. And it was only in reading the substance of the bill that it appeared to differ from the version that we had, in fact, which was old legislative concept 721, at least, and I've got copies of that, which had been put together by a tax incentive working group before the 99th session, which included AOC and LOC and a number of other sort of interests. And what the desire was in that piece of, in that bill or proposal, was to make sure that we were trying to attract this incentive to small business owners, economically sort of challenged communities, where the type of investment, you just can't make large investments. And in looking at the bill as it's written, it appears to actually require, or would actually cut out the types or large number of clients that we actually feel need to be served. We had sort of joined with the governor's, former governor's Community Solutions Office, and sort of talked about this concept as a tool, among others, for both economic development, but also quality of life and neighborhood revitalization, because it would be also targeted towards residential properties as well. In other words, you get the sort of you give a community a set of tools, and not just the business community. You give the entire community a set of tools. So I think my testimony outlines some of the things that we were concerned about, and frankly, we would be more than happy to work with anybody about this. I have really wanted to get this on the table and part of the debate in terms of both the legislatures and the governors. Overall strategies relating to economic development and bringing business and venture capitalists and people with $75 million in spare change and things like that, if they would just move to John Day, of course, it would be the best thing. Having said that, Mr. Chairman, I would be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Just one. And I kind of know what the answer, what your answer might be, but is the Parks Department the right place for this program, or should it may perhaps be in housing?
Mr. Chairman, the Parks Department has been managing all of the state and federal historic preservation programs since for over 30 years. We have a pretty well defined set of programs, and we have everything that we need to do to run it. And so I would suggest that it is probably, if we're going to do it, that it should easily stay there with us.
So sell me on it, though, other than historically, that's where it's been.
Ms. Chairman, we any number of our programs, grant programs, and the existing tax incentive programs that we administer, they all use the same criteria for determining whether or not a project should or shouldn't be approved. That includes a lottery-funded rehabilitation program as well. And I would assume, and this bill confirms it, that the same standards would be in place, and therefore, since I have professionally qualified staff to do it, we could, in fact, do it. I'm not sure that I could understand why, if I may, it would be better off at housing. Mm-hmm. We are going to be in the same building by the fall, I understand.
Oh, I didn't know that.
But and the you know the thing on the other end of the mall, which I had nothing to do with, but so and we do in fact work with and continue to work with the Community Solutions team even now, offering our incentives along with the other packages that they have to give to people. So I don't know if that's a good argument or not, but
appreciate it. Yeah, thank you. Thank you for your time.
Thanks.
Kevin Montgomery Smith from the Portland Business Alliance signed up in opposition to Senate Bill 778.
Hi, and thanks for having me. As Senator Starr said, this isn't an issue of being opposed to preservation or opposed to the tax credit idea. It is a question of trying to get the best possible program together. As Mr. Hamrick said, there are several different states that are using this. At my last count, it was 18, so there must be a whole slew of new states that are using different tax credit schemes. It is a question of whether or not it should be housed in parks, whether or not it should be housed in housing, which I'm not particularly in agreement with either one of those ideas. It is more of an economic development tool. It's a tool of creating jobs, of doing revitalization. So maybe it's a question of whether or not it should be in economic development or whether or not it should be in community development. But it's something that goes beyond putting a bell jar over a building and preserving it in the way that it was 100 years ago. It should be looked at as historic reuse. One of the ways that you can go through the different states and look at different ways that they're using the historic tax credits is by agreed upon uses or reuses of buildings. Shillito Lofts in Cincinnati is a perfect example of an old retail space, much like the Myron Frank building, that has been turned into 170 condo lofts, and you know, putting a building back on the tax roll that was completely vacant for 20 years in Cincinnati, the Ice House in Bucktown in Chicago, the exact same thing. So it's a change of use idea that really isn't in this bill. And also the idea that if maybe you're doing a change of use, if maybe you're not doing hall preservation, door preservation, window preservation, that it's a reduced tax credit. So maybe it's not a 25% tax credit, maybe it's a 20% tax credit, because the goal is to create the jobs, direct and indirect, that's coming from this investment. And that goal could be achieved if there was a 20% tax credit for something that was less than perfect historic preservation or putting a bell jar over a neighborhood. You don't find 800-year-old buildings in Paris that are exactly the way they were 800 years ago. It's adaptive reuse, and it's moving that building into the 21st century. I just wrote down a couple of notes about some of the best practice investigations. Massachusetts has a matching fund, so there's no general funds that are outlaid in the original tax credit proposal. Most states that are seeing a large growth of historic preservation, historic reuse, are using the tax credits in a saleable form so that you can sell them up front for upfront capital, just like the federal tax credits or low-income housing tax credits. Even if you're getting 81, 85, last time I heard in Missouri they were getting 87 cents on the dollar for state historic tax credits. It can amount to a huge sum. Massachusetts is using a document fee much like the one that's proposed currently by Bob Repine's office for community development on real estate transactions. So they're matching what local jurisdictions are doing for historic preservation. And, you know, that's one way to generate funds for the tax credit. And, again, creating the jobs that Mr. Hamrick's bill from 2 years ago, I believe, used Bay Area economics to talk about the number of jobs that could be achieved. And I thought they were incredibly conservative based on other states, but $30.5 million boost in construction activity after the first 5 years of the program, 321 jobs created annually, and that was direct jobs created, increased property values generating higher property tax revenue in the first 5 years, and then increased tourism and neighborhood revitalization. You can't underestimate that. And the one good thing in the bill that I thought was interesting, and only a few states do, is the tax credit for home ownership, because you can't use the federal tax credit currently in historic preservation for a home ownership model. So you couldn't take a building and do it as a condo. You could do it as a rental project, and in Missouri you can do it as a rental project, take the federal and the state, and then convert it after 15 years, I believe it's five, I'm sorry, after 5 years into a condo, and then reap the benefits of condoizing it and the additional tax revenue there. So, and another thing that I was thinking about when I was just sitting back there was the number of permits that have increased in the state of New Jersey from using something else that's totally different in historic rehabilitation subcode. There's just so many different things. 70% increase in historic activity in Newark, New Jersey over the first year, and still going strong. I think the big thing is to get away from the regulation, to try and free up the building and free up the neighborhood to be allowed to do something with the building that becomes economically viable. I saw William Connolly, the director of state codes from New Jersey recently, and he said, you know, the thing is, if somebody comes into your office and tells you they want to do a $2 million renovation on a building, it's never the right time. And the people who were in the know kind of chuckled, and the people who weren't, including myself, kind of scratched their head. But all the code guys were laughing, and they were laughing for one reason, because if somebody comes in and says they want to do a $2 million renovation, including a new roof, new windows, new something else, the code guy's going to go, you know, it's the right time to also seismically upgrade the building. You know what? It's also the right time to widen that staircase. It's also the right, and all of a sudden the $2 million, the $2 million investment that the city was going to get is a $6 million investment that they can't make, or a $4 million investment that they're not going to make. And then all of a sudden that pool of guys who go around looking for buildings to renovate starts drying up. This is obviously an idea that I think needs fleshing out, and I really say that as a preservationist, as somebody who wants to see buildings saved and return to the tax rolls and also contribute to the community. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for coming down. Appreciate it.
No problem.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, for holding the hearing on the bill.
No problem.
We'll endeavor to work on it.
Yeah, there does seem to be a real opportunity in hearing Mr. Montgomery Smith's testimony. There is a there on this, and that's, I guess, encouraging. 778, close the public hearing, and we are adjourned.